This is an audio version of the 24th Annual Dice Awards Roundtable Series. To watch the video of this episode, please visit youtube.com/officialAIAS.
Brought to you by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences. This is the award celebration by game makers for game makers, honoring the games that connect players around the globe. No matter where we come from or what our interests, video games bring us together. We gather here to honor our fellow creators and the very best of interactive entertainment. Welcome to the 24th Annual Dice Awards.
Let's dive in with the nominees for Outstanding Achievement in Game Design. I'd like to find out a little bit more about how each of you approaches your new assignments and how your work evolves over the development of your game, what you've learned or created throughout the course of making those games, and how that all works together to make the stuff that you've made for this year. This is the 24th Annual Dice Awards conversation with the nominees, so let's get to the introductions so we can ask you all some fantastic questions. First up, we have from Ghost of Tsushima, Nate Fox. How are you doing, Nate?
Feel great. I've got a lot of coffee on hand, so I'm going to speak very quickly in this. So I'm a creative director on Ghost of Tsushima, and my focus is really on a game design and how it integrates with narrative through systems and missions.
And no stare downs. I appreciate that. No stare downs in the game. From Hades, we have Amir Rao. How are you doing, Amir?
I'm good. Thank you.
Good to see you. Good to have you here. I'd love for you to share a little bit of info about some of the work you've done.
Sure. I'm the studio director of Supergiant Games. My focus is on coordinating our work together, and I also do game design at the studio. So on Hades specifically, I designed some of the content, and I tuned all of it. So enemies, boons, powers, weapons, and all that kind of stuff was my area of focus for Hades.
Perfect. We have lots of things to talk about, lots of things to discuss. From Half-Life Alyx, we have Corey Peters. How are you doing, Corey?
Oh, I'm doing great. I'm a level designer here at Valve, and on Half-Life Alyx, pretty much just focused on the player experience throughout the game.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Awesome to have you here as well. From Last of Us 2, we have Amelia Schatz and Richard Cambier. How are you doing?
Again.
Good to see you both. Amelia, give a little bit of info for the folks at home about the work that you've done.
Sure. I was a lead game designer on Last of Us Part 2, and that involved doing a lot of, like, from the start, like prototyping gameplay and systems and things like that. And but my real specialty is in level design and layout and thinking about how those systems interact with our environments so that we can have, for instance, lots of different combat encounters that use lots of different systems, and every single one of them feels different because of how you interact with the environment.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Richard, some thoughts about, you know, how you've been on this game development journey.
Yeah, thanks. It's really an honor to be here with everyone. Yeah, on The Last of Us Part II, I was a co-lead with Em, and likewise focus a lot on level layout. Also, you know, really passionate about making sure that we're achieving the goals of the story within, like, all of the levels and all of the systems, and kind of making sure we're getting that cohesion between this, all those different areas. And then also a particular passion of mine on Part Two was the AI, and kind of seeing what different advancements we could make with that and how those fit and to achieve some of the same story and level goals.
Very, very cool. And for Marvel's Spider-Man Miles Morales, we have Cameron Christian. How are you doing, Cameron?
I'm doing good. I'm game director over at Insomniac Games, and I help kind of direct all things combat, traversal, mission design. You know, my background originally is in layout and systems. So yeah, just really helped guide that team.
Well, thank you all for joining us. I'm super excited to dig in a little bit more into the work that you all do and talk about that in respect for the games that you've made. A kind of general question for the room, and we'll go around the horn in terms of answers, would be, you know, as game designers, you're most kind of responsible for how the responsibilities of those games have kind of changed through the technology and how it's grown. You know, when new technology has kind of come into the space and has become available, you know, how has that kind of changed the way you've thought about game design, and how has that kind of moved the game design idea kind of forward in terms of the games that you've made? Amir, I'm going to start off with you on that one. What are your thoughts about that?
That one's it's maybe tougher for our 2D video game made with a team of of less than 17 people. So, I mean, I would say that as a team, we're actually really focused on constraints. And as a small team, we like to embrace the constraints we have. And our constraints are actually much more just around our team size, what we're good at, and what we're preoccupied with. Whenever technology or tools come along that that kind of make those processes easier on us, it's always to our benefit. It makes us more efficient and that type of thing. But as a team, we're sort of relentlessly focused on the experience of the game. And so, you know, we just try to work together and collaborate to make it work for us.
Nate, I'd love to hear your thoughts as well about, you know, how the responsibilities have kind of changed, you know, with new technology kind of being in the space.
I think the technology is it feels like it just keeps coming, and you know, things become much more lush and experiential. And if anything, that says you really need to keep your eye on the ball of what the experience is you're trying to give people. Suddenly that becomes more and more important as, you know, graphic fidelity improves and, you know, animation nuance. It's no longer can we pull it off, it's what do we pull off with these things. And that's the real measure that suddenly becomes just the most important decision that you have to have made early on.
Yeah. Amelia and Richard, I'd love to hear a little bit of a take on that too, especially kind of bouncing off of what Nate shared in terms of limitations now not necessarily being as grand as they previously were, and kind of you having new trade-offs in terms of what you want to be able to do as opposed to what you were able to do in previous.
I mean, for us, it's always about like, how can we get our ideas in the game as fast as possible? So for us, it's just constant iteration. We play the game, something's not right, and we try to fix it. And so as sort of technology evolves, kind of our priority as designers is how can we make it work for us so we can do things faster, like faster builds, faster, just seeing the results in game. But the other part of it is that, you know, as our environments, our games become so much more, I don't know, lush and beautiful, as you were saying, I think that that puts a lot of pressure on, for instance, layout design, on thinking about what that experience is going to look like at the end. We're not looking at a very rough sort of warehouse environment anymore. And from the very beginning, as I'm sort of laying out a level space, I need to have a lot more, I think my designers need to have a lot more knowledge of architecture and history and how plants grow into ruins and things like that. Because a lot of times just at that block mesh stage, like we are expected to have a bit of that sort of art direction and figuring out like how do these spaces work together. And of course, we do work as closely as we can with the environment artists that eventually you know, flesh out those spaces for us. But we really have to, it's meant that we have to take on a lot of that responsibility ourselves as well. And yeah.
Richard, any thoughts to add to that?
I think she really touches on some of the large scale stuff. I also think for us, it's all the little details too that we get to push for the technology of like, okay, you know, for example, maybe we had some plants in the space, and now how do we get them to move well as the player moves through them? When we talk about immersion, we talk about that feeling of like, you know, more of the things in the world move or break or react to you, your feeling of being in the space. I think that's areas where technology has really increased that feeling or improved that feeling. And for us, a lot of that is, you know, not only in some of our ideas of like, you know, what improved technology with our flashlight or our lighting technology that can really add this, again, this immersive feel or this creepy feel or that some of the intensity that goes into The Last of Us, but also really encouraging that other teams and departments that's looking through the dice list again and being like, oh yeah, it's the advancements in the animation, it's the advancements in the art direction, it's the advancements of all these other departments, and getting those departments excited and asking, getting them to ask the questions, what do you want to see improved? You know, effects department, what do you want to see improved? What do you think we can do that we've never done before? It's going to add to moments of like, you know, tears dropping from Ellie and that landing on the cloth. Now you see that go, you're like, okay, that's kind of amazing.
Yeah, it's stuff like that definitely adds this layer of immersion that we haven't seen before and is growing in our expectations now of what we kind of hope to see as the player. Corey, I'm kind of curious to hear your chime in on this as well. What are some of the kind of responsibilities that you found that have changed, you know, because of new technology and even stuff that you all have kind of made in-house to kind of help this move forward as well?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, with Half-Life Alyx, it was kind of fun in a lot of ways because we were dealing with new technology. A lot of the games that we've made in the past were just sort of, it's iterative where you've got more processing power, you can do more, you can put more enemies on the screen and stuff like that. But with VR, all of a sudden we had an independent view and you had two hands to manipulate the world with. And that just led to a whole different discovery chain that would just happen through every single playtest that we would end up doing. Players would just keep doing things or expecting things to work. And we would have to basically revisit the drawing board and go back and go, oh, okay, well, how do we solve this problem? Players want to do X. How do we give that to them? And so, you know, coupling that with the technology side of things, we were developing, you know, our new controllers at the time too. And so that led to all sorts of other fun things of not just pushing buttons on controllers, but being able to grasp and manipulate objects with your hands and being able to let players just explore their environment the way you might normally explore an environment. Really, really exciting stuff.
Yeah, it feels like that even has come through a lot in Miles Morales, where, you know, light has been a very, very specific part of that game that feels very different in the way that it conveys, you know, the new powers that Miles has in the game. You know, he has these extra abilities now compared to Peter Parker, and, you know, he's developed these new powers alongside, you know, his story kind of emerging through this. You know, do you feel like the technology in this space, Cameron, has kind of helped you to really pull those things to the forefront of saying, like, these new powers that he has, you know, we weren't able to do this in the previous game. We weren't able to do this in with the tech that we had before in these kind of more bigger and profound ways.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think you hit it right there with Miles. A big part is his electric powers and like how we showcase that with VFX and dynamic lights and all that stuff is something we couldn't hit it on a fidelity level that we're able to hit now. And it just really starts connecting you and immersing you even more in the game. You know, I think for us too, another fun thing on the technology front is we were a launch title for PlayStation 5. And so, you know, we got to play with the new controller a lot and like, what is that? What is the new vibration? And just with games in general, new tech is just fun to play and experiment with. And so having the ability to be like, how does this new, you know, PS5 controller work? What can we do with it? How can we push feedback on it? Was another thing in that whole package of like Miles' powers and how we get that feeling and the look and the immersion going. So it's all super exciting.
Yeah, it's really cool how all of that has kind of come together. I remember very specifically the first time I used Venom power and my screen lit up in a way that I didn't have an expectation for. I'd seen trailers and I'd seen other stuff before, and it was different in a way that felt tangible, not only to the way that the gameplay experience happened, but to the way you were telling the new story of this character. So it definitely feels like there was a leap, no pun intended, in terms of the ways things have kind of maneuvered in that space. Go ahead, Cameron.
It's like you start hitting levels sometimes where you can draw everything, but is that good? You know, like we had an issue where it's just like so much effects. We started to just like kind of pull it back because you're like, you can go that far, but now players can't see anything, you know? So that's the other challenge with new technology and kind of pushing those bounds further, you know? How do you sculpt it to keep it readable and playable?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I love the most about Hades in that way is that it feels like with every layer of that game, each part of it kind of, you know, unveils itself as this extra layer of this beautiful cake that we get a chance to kind of partake in. And it feels like the boons is a part of that conversation is very specific to that and how the players kind of interact with those and you know, mixing and matching and finding out ways to use that to find good ways for combat. You know, what was your goal when kind of designing each of the gods' abilities? They have such a breadth and depth of what they do in the world and how that connects to lore and then how that connects to the player and their abilities to kind of, you know, play the way they want. You know, what was the conversation that happened when you wanted to give the player this really kind of big bounty of tools at their disposal?
Yeah, it's a combination of what does the game need? You know, like what is an example of something that the game still lacks a player power that might be an interesting build path for them? And that's kind of more of a game design perspective. And then there's also the question of what does the narrative require and what are people's expectations of the gods? You know, some of them just feel like they were like brilliantly game designed thousands of years ago with, you know, Poseidon and Zeus. The powers there are a little bit more obvious. But then for something like Demeter, you know, in Hades' expression of Demeter is that she's really, really upset that Persephone is gone missing. And so, you know, she blankets the world in eternal ice. And that's a kind of our unique interpretation on Demeter. I don't think you necessarily expect ice powers from her, but it's also came out of a game need in our early access, which is Hades got really, 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 really fast over the course of its early access. And there was a need for a set of boons that basically slowed the enemies down in some way and opened up some of these other powers. And at the intersection of like our needs on the design side and our desire to portray Demeter in this specific way as the goddess of the seasons and specifically cold, we basically wrap those things together.
Yeah. The part that I remember from when I first initially got to play Hades was just how all of those systems started to kind of unfold. And then you're like, oh, if I mix and match these things, I can min-max to a certain extent my actual abilities to be able to play this game in a way that feels good for me, which I thought was actually pretty brilliant in the way that you all have laid that out in that way. You know, kind of building off of that conversation, I want to poke back with Richard and Amelia about, you know, in The Last of Us 2, you already had some fantastic mechanics that were coming from the previous game. It showed itself in, you know, the way you did, you know, stealth, the way you did movement, the way you did those kind of really intimate fights that wind up happening at very close combat spaces. You know, how did you kind of build on those mechanics in the first game to deliver like an even more powerful player experience? I'll start off with Richard on that one.
Okay, good question. I can kind of, you know, ramble a little bit, but I think early on, you know, we went through some pre-production and it's those times when we open things up to the team and be like, you know, here's some goals, let's play around. And we get things like, you know, even as simple of like being able to go prone. You know, that was a huge change from the last one, right? But it fits right in line with some of the feelings of stealth. It works well with introducing things like grass and even just the own pace of the game of like, okay, being able to slow things down a little bit in some moments and being able to like look around and that feeling, that tension that we wanted to create intentionally. So that's something that fit in like really well with some of the overall design goals. And I felt like built on the previous series. And then eventually, and even things on the other side of being like, how do we also increase mobility? And, you know, again, just like, movement set in terms of like level layout too, adding those things that Ellie can like squeeze through very quickly within the space of a layout, right? So you kind of have two different things and well, one hand slow you down and another one increase your mobility to kind of give you more agency within the level layout, give the level layout team a little more options, a little more things to think about within the space. That was at least maybe two examples of something. I'll let Amelia talk on any others that come to mind for her.
I was thinking about like, coming from The Last of Us Part One, there was a lot of stuff that I think we wanted to add or that we could blue sky, but we really wanted to be careful and be conservative about what we add because everything we sort of add has a consequence. And one of the things that we struggled a lot with early on is adding a lot more traversal verticality to our environments because of how much we sort of rely on a very like cat and mouse stealth mechanics. You know, when you are in trouble, we really like to control the amount of pressure that we have on the player that the enemies can sort of push on you. And as we sort of add verticality, like that adds another layer to the chess puzzle, another layer to the chess puzzle. And it means that if you are able to climb, as well as like Nathan Drake, for instance, because we sort of started out with some prototypes of Ellie like climbing all sorts of stuff. And That means that, that really means that you have a lot of mobility, but then the enemies, how do they counteract that? If you're able to sort of like all of a sudden climb up into the ceiling or climb up here, you're completely out of view of all the enemies. And it really, really changes things, because in The Last of Us Part One, Joel could barely jump. Like he could maybe traverse onto something, but he didn't, there wasn't a whole lot of jumping mechanics in there. And so that was a big risk early on, like how much we really want to add in, because it really, really does change the combat. And so it changed how our AI have to think about like moving around spaces and stuff like that. So that took a long time, but in the end, we came up with something that it really feels, I think, like there's a lot of pressure on the player, but yet you have so many more tools at your disposal than you did in the previous game. And I go back and play The Last of Us Part One, and I try to dodge, you know, when they try to punch me and it doesn't work, there is no dodge button. And I love the new sort of ways that you can interact with the spaces, and it just kind of makes the world feel just a lot more of a convincing world that you can live in when you can see all those things that you can actually do and interact with the space. Like Richard said, squeezing through just a little hole between like two like shelves in a grocery store or something like that. And that sort of really pairs with the kind of physicality that we really wanted to have you feel as Ellie, as a small person with all these scary sort of enemies around you, that squeezing through spaces like that kind of has that sort of sense of like hiding and seeking. And it just, as I said earlier, it just is a long iterative process of adding and subtracting, and then subtracting a lot, and then adding a little bit more, and that sort of stuff. So.
Really quick before I pivot, how much of the interactivity parts kind of dictated the way level design happened in that game? Was it something that came in kind of from the conceptual stages of saying, you know, I know that there was a part of that interactivity that wound up being, you know, a way that you kind of told narrative pieces of the story as well, but it feels like, you know, thinking about the game now, that maybe have been a part of the conversation from the early beginnings of that game too. Am I right in thinking that, or am I off?
Well, I mean, I think that in the end, like our game design, our systems, our level design is in service of telling a story. But at the very beginning of production, it's all thinking about systems and setups. And that's what we're doing, is just we're creating combat setups. We're creating little like puzzles, traversal things, all sorts of things like that, to try to really like flesh out those systems to see how much we can possibly interact with the world and interact with NPCs in meaningful and interesting ways. And then that sort of, as we sort of get further in production, starts to get layered in with those, with the narrative, and figuring out like, okay, we had this really cool setup. I think that could really help tell this moment, trying to like describe the feeling that Ellie's supposed to be feeling at this moment. And I think that this particular environment that we tested out actually really works well with that.
Yeah, it definitely feels like it was at the forefront of the conversation, and not something that kind of came in after, you know, things kind of landed. Nate, I'm really curious, because I think one of the parts that I as a player think about often when you have a much larger sprawling game like you have, you end Cameron with Miles Morales, is the push and pull between, you know, giving the player the narrative spots to kind of get through the main quest of the story, while also giving them tasks to do to kind of, you know, boost their level, or to get them into, you know, adding side quests and stories that kind of fill out the world in that way. You know, how did you go about the process of balancing those various tasks with the kind of, you know, complete Jin story that you wound up sharing in Tsushima?
Well, we started out thinking of the game as an anthology of stories, not just, you know, necessarily the hero's arc. And that really informed a lot of how we thought about the construction of the game, in that if you kind of followed your curiosity, you would find something worth discovering, be it a reward or a story. And so the game was built around this idea of just being in the landscape, right? Versus being on a path defined by the story of Jin's transformation. Certainly that's the backbone of the game, but it's not the center for why the game got made, right? The reason that the game got made is that you could feel like you're a samurai in feudal Japan. And everything that gets made is just to serve that one singular objective. And so in balancing it, you know, we certainly create the story of Jin's transformation into the ghost. And then all those other things, you just need to make sure that they are kind of satellites around that central theme. You know, how does getting to know the sensei who had a bad relationship with his student comment on our hero's relationship with his teacher, his uncle? And so that the stories aren't sort of completely independent from one another, the experiences are isolated, but they all feel like they're kind of going towards one truth, one statement about who this character is.
That totally fits. I thinking back on what I've played, all those convergences do feel like they actually do meet at that pinnacle, right? Of figuring out what Jin's story was and his feelings of honor and his feelings of family and his feelings of connectiveness to the world around him. Thank you for sharing that. I think that definitely does pull that into focus in a different way that I hadn't thought of before. Cameron, I'm kind of curious about that from the Miles Morales perspective. You have this amazing world that you've built, and you have this kind of bunch of characters that are, you know, ones that the community kind of understands. And then you have this kind of, you know, newer character who you're still trying to give enough of a footing for people to give a lot of care about and care for. How did you all kind of balance that out in terms of gameplay, and again, of kind of building out that initial story arc and within the game, and also giving the player lots of things to do to kind of fill that in?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for us was a challenge because we have the central story, right? And throughout our production, there was a lot of back and forth as how do we get the player to branch out from the story? You know, like, that's the thing I appreciate about Ghosts. I did feel that anthology of it, like all the stories came together. And so I wanted to go out there, and I felt I was pulled in many directions. And for us, you know, since we had this main, somewhat at times urgent story, there was a lot of in our process, like how can we pull down the urgency and then push the player out to go explore and check out some other stories and check out New York and see like, hey, there's other stuff going on. I think a big thing for us is we tried to build this connection to New York through one of our mechanics, which was like the friendly neighborhood app. And essentially it's just kind of fancy presentation to show quests that the citizens of New York is posting for Miles. And so having that kind of reconnected him to the different, different districts of New York to try to kind of pull him out there, along with other like economy things. And just, it's fun to swing around. So we have that as a luxury in some ways. People are just swinging us around the city naturally. And so we gently try to nudge them to side content while they're doing that.
Yeah. Corey, I'm kind of curious about that from Half-Life Alyx perspective, because you have a very special thing that you have to account for, which is the player and in their bodies being in VR physically. You know, your eyes get tired, your head gets tired from having a headset on. What's the conversation that you all kind of talked through about, you know, how do we want to kind of display this story in a way that also gives you the satisfaction as a player to feel like you've had this epic journey, but also doesn't make you tired when you're like, I need to take this headset off, or my eyes hurt for being that close to a VR screen. I'm curious to hear your thoughts about that before you wrap.
Sure. It was interesting during the development of Alyx, if only that as we got further and further along, that sort of fatigue that you're talking about sort of went away. Like when we started, we were initially thinking that, oh, well, we'll design chunks of content and then kind of have little safe areas in between, you say like 30 to 45 minutes in through an experience where it felt like, oh, okay, I can take a breather, I can take a break and you know, come back when I'm refreshed. And as sort of the technology got better, our headsets got better, the comfort level went up, but also the content just kept getting more and more engaging. And so it was actually pretty funny sometimes during some of the play tests, you would have somebody in there for 2 hours just playing, and they would take the headset off. And there's like, how long am I in there for? You know, it's like, well, 2 hours. It's like, oh my goodness, I've never been in VR for that long before. And then they would just put the headset back and keep going. So it was really inspiring in some ways when that stuff happened. But with like regards to the narrative stuff, being actually physically Alex is an interesting proposition, because you're able to manipulate everything in the world much more than you used to be able to before. And being able to tell a story through Alex became an interesting challenge, since in the previous games, we've never had the protagonist talk. Like Gordon is a silent protagonist. He's always getting talked to. And it was interesting to try and explore what happens if we make Alex talk. And it was interesting because even on the team, I think we were probably split 50-50 that was going to be a good idea or not. And it wasn't until we actually started executing on it and putting real voiceover and stuff like that into the game that people started responding more positively to it. And then even making changes where it's like, oh, well, we've discovered that the more that Alex emotes things happening, it actually is a negative for players' responses, because they may not be actually scared by a zombie that comes around the corner. And so we would just remove that kind of stuff, and it would just become smoother and smoother, and couple the player sort of with the personality of Alex. But then also we had Russell that was in your ear the whole time, and so he could comment on things that you were seeing, and so that just kept it fun and light. So even if the player was feeling particularly scared or a tense situation, he could make light of it, and it would just sort of break the ice a little bit. And the player, you could see them physically kind of calm down when Russell would come back over the radio. So it was a fun way to weave the narrative of the story with Russell talking to you and Alex talking back, just about all the things that you're doing together as you move through the environment.
That's super cool. I've had those moments in VR too, where I've just been like, what, where am I? I don't know what's happening at this point. And now I'm definitely sucked into kind of getting into the new one, into more of the game for to sort of speak. Here's the fun part of doing all of this. I get to give away an award right now, so I'm super excited about that. Now we're going to dig into it. The winner of the DICE Award for Outstanding Achievement Game Design is Hades. Congratulations, congrats.
Oh, thank you.
Super, wow. Super cool. Amir, do you have any quick thoughts to share with folks?
Thank you very much.
As you snag this bad boy.
Oh, well, it's a huge honor to have been nominated among a group of just amazing games this year. Really, really well-designed games. Games that try to do a lot of what we hope to do in terms of like melding world building and atmosphere and narrative with their mechanics. And frankly, it's just amazing to even be included in the conversation with these games, which are huge, huge inspiring productions that are really, really complicated to put together. And, you know, means a lot for our small design team. So thank you very much.
Well, again, thank you all for being here. Thank you so much for using your talents to make these beautiful, wonderful games and these experiences. Nate, Amir, Corey, Amelia, Richard, and Cameron, thank you so much for being here and for being a part of our award show today. Super excited to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences is excited to share that the 2022 DICE Summit and DICE Awards will be returning in person to the gorgeous Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino and Delano Hotel in Las Vegas on February 22nd to 24th, 2022. We'll be celebrating the 25th anniversary of the DICE Awards and bringing together industry leaders to share their ideas about the many facets of the interactive entertainment industry. Stay tuned to www.interactive.org and our Twitter, @official_AIAS, for more details coming soon, including special anniversary rates. We can't wait to see you again.